Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with Lafayette Glen Seabrook Learning Center. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Michael Carr, former National Franchise Director and Senior Commercial Manager at BP, and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. Our moderator tonight is Joe Epstein. Joe is president of Sierra Steel Trading, a San Francisco-based steel products merchant. He is the past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. Joe now sits on the board of the Commonwealth Club of California, the board advisors of the Oakland Boys and Girls Club, and the board advisor to the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley. Now I want to introduce our speaker tonight for tonight's program. Meg Whitman was born in Long Island, New York. Although Meg was raised in Long Island, her intrepid and adventurous mother, Margaret, packed the six-year-old Meg and her brothers and sister into a Ford Econoline van in 1962 and spent 3 months camping throughout the West. She received her degree in economics from Princeton University and an MBA from Harvard Business School. After graduating from Harvard, Ms. Whitman returned to San Francisco as a young bride with her husband, Griff, who's here tonight, a neurosurgeon at Sanford Hospital. They now have two adult sons, and Ms. Whitman and her family are ardent outdoor enthusiasts who love hiking, skiing, fly fishing, and all of California's natural treasures. Before working at eBay, Meg Whitman held key executive positions at Disney, StrideRight, FTD, Hasbro. And in the fall of 1997, she met the founder of eBay, at which time a tiny startup company with $4.7 million in revenues and 30 employees. Meg immediately saw the potential of eBay and transformed the company into a giant success that we know today, with $8 billion in revenues and 15,000 employees worldwide. Time magazine ranked her among the world's most influential people. Fortune ranked her the most powerful woman in business in 2004, 2005, and Business Week listed her among the top managers year after year. After eBay, she served as a national finance co-chair for Mitt Romney's 2008 presidential primary campaign, and then served as a national co-chair for the 2008 McCain-Palin presidential campaign. Ms. Whitman is a current Republican candidate for governor of California. And she once stated, "California seems larger than life, a place where anything is possible." If elected governor of California, Ms. Whitman would be the first female to hold this office. It is my honor to ask you, along with the Commonwealth Club of California, to please welcome and give a hearty big hand for Ms. Meg Whitman.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club for inviting me tonight. I'm just delighted to be here. And what I thought I might do is tell you a little bit about myself. I've not met many of you before. And then tell you why I'm running for governor and the vision that I have for what California can become. And everyone, almost the first question I get when I meet a group of people is, why does anyone want this job? So I'll tell you about that, and then give you a quick update on the status of the race, and then I'd love to answer questions moderated by Joe. So, as you mentioned, just quickly, I was born and raised on Long Island. I'm the youngest of three children, and I am a product of the public school system. I went to K-12 public school, and I have a passion for public education, and I'll talk more about that in a bit. My dad worked in New York, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, although I think in a very adventurous stay-at-home mom. And you know what she instilled in me? She instilled in me a bias for action. She used to say, Meg, the price of inaction is far greater than the cost of making a mistake. And she told us stories growing up that really embedded that in who we were as children. And I'll share one story with you that I think you will appreciate. So during World War II, my mother wanted to contribute to the war effort, like so many of her generation. So she did what was available to women at the time, which is she joined the Red Cross in Boston. And I think she thought she'd stay in Boston. It would be quite safe and easy. But on that first day, they said, actually, we need this class of women to go to New Guinea in the South Pacific. So she flew from Boston to San Francisco, then got on a troop ship for 30 days to New Guinea. She said the very best thing about that was that she got seasick and lost 30 pounds. But she arrived in New Guinea, and the base commander said, we have a shortage of airplane mechanics and truck mechanics. Which of you women would like to volunteer? My mother raised her hand. My mother had never looked under the hood of anything. But she knew where the need was greatest, and really the challenge fueled her. And 4 years later, she was a fully certified airplane mechanic and a fully certified truck mechanic. And she told us children, she said, you can do anything you want because I can overhaul a Jeep engine faster than the men. I was lucky enough to be in just the fourth class of women to attend Princeton University. There were about 100 of us in a class of 1,200, and we had a great time for a whole variety of reasons. Then went on to Harvard Business School, and then, of course, ended up in California. And I'll tell you a funny story. So my husband needed to pick a city to do 7 years of neurosurgery residency, and that's my husband, Griff Harsh, over there, if you could just... And he got into two training programs. He got into the University of California at San Francisco and Harvard's teaching hospital, the Mass General. And he looked at me with a little twinkle in his eye, and he said, Meg, your mother lives in Boston. We should go to California. And so as newlyweds, we decamped to the Haight-Ashbury, below UCSF. And we fell in love with California from the beginning. We loved every minute of our time living in San Francisco and in California. And I started my first job in California, which was actually for Bain & Company, the management consulting firm. And the reason that you will care about that is my first boss, and my boss for most of the 10 years I worked there, was actually Mitt Romney. And that, of course, is how I ended up working on his presidential campaign many years later. I had the opportunity to work for some great companies in California. Our two boys were born here. We now have a 25-year-old and a 22-year-old, two boys. But you can imagine that the job that changed my way of thinking more than just about anything else was eBay. And Michael's exactly right. I joined eBay as a tiny little startup. I joined a founder by the name of Pierre Omidyar, a Persian-American, who had started eBay in 1995. And by the time 1997 rolled around, he was looking for a CEO. He was a computer scientist. And eBay was growing at 70% compound monthly growth rate, meaning every month the company was 70% bigger than the month before. And so he needed help to run the company. And I came out really very skeptical. I thought, you know, I don't know. This may not work out. I'm not sure. But after a day with Pierre, I was taken by the power of the internet and the power of what he had created. Because what Pierre had created, of course, was a level playing field where your next door neighbor had an equal chance of success to a large corporation. We created the conditions for small businesses to grow and thrive. And I saw that on the day that I met Pierre. And at the end of the day, I said to him, what are you looking for in a CEO? And I thought he might say financial acumen, strategic capability, leadership. And he looked at me with a little twinkle in his eye, and he said, adult supervision. Because Pierre was only 29 years old, and he was the oldest person in the company. But as someone like who could say that, Pierre did not need adult supervision. He was 29 going on 40, one of the most remarkable entrepreneurs that I have ever met, and we're still good and close friends. In any case, we had the opportunity to build eBay from 30 people to 15,000 employees, from $4.7 million in revenue to nearly $8 billion in revenue. But I think the fact that I am most proud of is that today, well over a million individuals make most, if not all, of their living selling on eBay around the globe. And eBay became the platform for small businesses on the internet. And what I saw every day was the power of small business, the courage, the inspiration, the challenges that small business people face was startling to me, but it was a remarkable experience. And I also saw how the government can get in the way of small business, taxation, bureaucracy, and regulation. And we had sellers in all 50 states. And I can tell you firsthand, this is one of the most difficult states in the country in which to do business. I saw it every single day. So that experience, combined with the experience that I had working on Mitt Romney's team and John McCain's team, inspired me in many ways to think beyond a career in business to serving the public, to serving in the public good. And no matter what you think about John McCain and Mitt Romney's politics or their campaigns, they're both great Americans. They're great patriots, and they were running for the right reason. So those experiences combined with what I saw happening to this state I love. I love California. It's where my two boys were born. Griff was trained to be a doctor here. It was where eBay was born. And California has historically been an inspiration to the United States and to the world. And when I saw what was happening to this state, I had to sit back and I said, you know what? I just refuse to believe that California cannot be better than it is. What has happened to this state over the last decade or so is simply remarkable. And you know the statistics. Today we have a 12.4% unemployment rate, which is about fourth highest in the nation. The underemployment rate, meaning people who are working 30 hours a week who'd like to be working 40, or people who have given up looking for work, is now closer to 17%. I see the heartbreak on the campaign trail every single day. Kids who can't go back to UC because fees have gone up by 32% and one of their parents has lost a job. I was down at the largest John Deere dealership in Southern California. They are laying off people who have worked for their company for 30 years. Husbands telling wives, wives telling husbands they can't hang on to a house they bought just 2 or 3 years ago because one of them has lost a job. So we have an enormous challenge on our hands, and I'll come back to that in a moment. We have an infrastructure that was built for a population half our size. The water crisis in the Central Valley is the best exhibit of this. Third, we have a kindergarten through 12th grade education system that is now near the bottom of the pack. In the 1950s, we had among the very best public school systems in the country. Today, we are close to the bottom. And this is simply not acceptable. We are going to, if we do not fix this, we're going to end up with a second-rate workforce in a second-rate state. And then last but not least, we have a fiscal crisis on our hands. The state is a fiscal mess. We are now facing yet another budget deficit, this time $20 billion over the next 18 months. So here's the approach that I want to take. We are going to have to do some things very differently if we're going to turn California around. I think we can turn California around, but here's the approach that we're going to need to take. I am a big believer in focus. Let's do 3 things at 100% as opposed to 10 things at 15 or 20%. I think that's especially true when you face the crisis that we face in California. Because if you go to Sacramento with an agenda that is too broad, you will be stymied by the legislature, by the incumbent interest, by the bureaucracy. So you've got to put every bit of enthusiasm, skill, policy against these 3 things. And here they are. First and foremost, we have to create and keep jobs in California. If we do not put Californians back to work, there is no way out of this mess. So priority number one has got to put Californians back to work, which means we fundamentally have to change the business climate in California. You probably know that we are bleeding jobs to Colorado, Arizona, Utah, Texas. And you know why? It's simpler and easier and cheaper to do business there. So first is creating and keeping jobs in California. Second, we've got to rein in government spending. I have done what many of you would do who are in business in the audience. I dove deeply into the financials of the state of California. And trust me when I tell you, we have a spending problem of epic proportions. This is the farthest thing you can imagine from smart, efficient government. And we have been told that you either have 2 choices. You either raise taxes or cut services. It's not true. There is a third way. We can run this government far more efficiently for the benefit of the taxpayers. And then last but not least is the kindergarten through 12th grade education system. As I said, it is not acceptable that the vast majority of children in California are not getting a world-class education. There are many fine public schools in California. Maybe some of your children or grandchildren go to them, but the vast majority are not doing the job. So we are going to have to get about this. So it's not that other things don't matter. They do. But if we don't fix these 3 things, I'm not sure that we will ever get to anything else that matters to many of you in this room. So how are we going to do that? Let me give you a few ideas in each of the categories. So first is jobs. The first thing I want to do is I want to call for a moratorium on all new regulations in California. As I have traveled this state, I expected to get an earful on taxes, and I have, and I'll come back to taxes. But actually, when you talk to business people of all, running businesses of all sizes, they will tell you that if you could do one thing, it would be to streamline regulation. So let's call for a moratorium on all new regulations, and then let's sort through what we have. Let's remove the duplication. Let's make it easy to open a small business. Let's make it easy to expand by creating a master application where you put all of your information into one application, and then behind the scenes, the government is helping you out. You know, it's interesting. When I was the CEO of eBay, we wanted to build a new building in Silicon Valley for our subsidiary PayPal. Many of you probably know eBay owns PayPal. It was going to be 3,000 white-collar jobs in the heart of Silicon Valley. I thought that the government of the state of California would be my new best friend. How can we help you get this building built faster? How can we get these 3,000 people to work? Hardly. 2.5 years later, 25 permits, 3 consulting firms to navigate the labyrinth of California regulations, we were finally able to break ground. But the truth is, it's not competitive with a state like Texas or a state like Colorado. So first is regulations. I also want to look very carefully at things like workplace flexibility and rules. This is a small thing, but I don't know how many of you know, but in California, we're one of a handful of states that if you work 10 hours a day for 4 days a week, your employer still has to pay you 2 hours of overtime every day. So if you work 40 hours over 5 days, fine. If you work 40 hours over 4 days, your employer has to pay you overtime, which creates all kinds of issues for number of people. I know at eBay, we had lots of women who wanted to work 10 hours a day for 4 days a week. In California, it's not acceptable. Meal and rest periods are creating all kinds of challenges for our retail establishments, for our hospitality establishments. So let's work on reforming regulation, streamlining regulation, and making this the very best place to open a business and to grow a business. Second is taxes. Now, my view is that I would very much like to enact an across-the-board tax cut. We pay the highest corporate tax rates, the highest individual tax rates, and the highest sales tax rates. My view is right now that's actually not practical, not facing a $20 billion budget deficit. So let's provide targeted tax relief. If you come back to my notion that if the first priority is to create jobs in California and keep jobs in California, then let's put tax relief in that leads immediately to hiring. I'll give you a couple of examples. We have something in California called the factory tax, meaning if you are a manufacturer in California, you have to pay sales tax on the equipment that you buy to manufacture in the state. We're one of only 3 states in the whole country that requires that. It's the best reason that manufacturers have to go to a Nevada, to go to an Oregon, to go to a Utah. So let's eliminate the factory tax. Let's increase the R&D tax credit. California is the home to innovation. The day we lose our innovation edge is the day we have even bigger problems on our hands. So let's increase the R&D tax credit to 20% so it comports with the federal level. Let's take a look at making it easier to start new businesses. This is a small example, but did you know one of the biggest stop signs that entrepreneurs face when they want to start their own business is you have to pay an $800 fee to open an LLC in California? And $800 might not seem much to some of you, but I tell you, if you are going to quit your day job, you're going to hire a couple of people, you don't know when the revenue is going to come in. My eBay sellers told me all the time that $800 was a big barrier to starting their own business in California. And then last but not least on jobs, we're going to have to stand up and compete. 30 years ago, I don't think we had much competition from neighboring states. We were the golden state. We were where everyone wanted to be. But I will tell you, Colorado, Utah, Texas, they are competing for our jobs. I don't know if you saw over Valentine's Day, but the governor of Colorado sent Valentine's Day cards to the CEOs of the major companies in California, trying to entice them to come to Colorado. And the card said, "Colorado loves California." So we are going to have to compete. And what I will do is I will be on the phones making sure that we know what companies are thinking about leaving, where they're thinking of going, where they're thinking of expanding, and then what companies can we bring back to California. And you know what broke my heart was, I don't know if you read, but Northrop Grumman, the last aerospace headquarters that was headquartered in Long Beach, California, is leaving for Virginia. They're not leaving for, you know, India or China or Eastern Europe or Australia. They're leaving for Virginia. And you know what? That is just wrong. That was a signature industry for California. And people said, well, it's only 300 people at headquarters. Well, you know what happens when headquarters leaves. So this is the kind of thing we're going to have to do. So first is jobs. Second is spending. I think there's $15 billion worth of spending cuts that we can make that would actually make this government run far more efficiently and effectively. Things like utilizing technology to do things more effectively. Streamlining the government workforce down by 40,000 people. Here's an interesting story for you. Today, the revenues in the state of California are about $83 to $85 billion in the general fund, down from over $100 billion several years ago. So I asked the question, when was the last time revenues in California were at that level? It turns out it was 2004, 2005. I then asked the next question, which is, and how many people did we have working for the state just 5 years ago? 40,000 fewer. Today, we have 357,000 people who work for the state of California. So let's do things more efficiently so we can run the state with fewer people. And we can get there through attrition. About 10,000 civil servants retire every year. If we didn't hire anyone for 3 years, we'd be back down to where we were 5 years ago. So those are the kinds of things I want to look at. We've got to look at welfare reform. We've got to look at pension reform. We can talk about some of those in the question and answer. And then last but not least is our kindergarten through 12th grade education system. So everyone talks about this, and we actually have to change the trajectory here. So I want to do three things, and I am a big believer in the 80-20. What is 20% of the reforms that you can get that will get you 80% of the way home? And I think these are the three that we have to look at very carefully in California. First, we've got to grade every single public school a simple letter grade, A through F, so that every parent knows how good or not so good their child's school is. Now, you can find that out today in California. There's 10 factors. You have to look quite carefully. It's hard to compare. But let's give every single school a very transparent letter grade. They did this in Florida, and you know what happened? They said it increased parent involvement dramatically, because when you told parents their son or daughter was in an F school, they were pretty interested in that. Then I think we need to increase the number of charter schools. Charter schools simply do a better job around teaching our children. Not every charter school is perfect, but on average, they do a better job because the principals have more authority. And I think we've got to remove the cap on charter schools. I don't know how many of you know, we have a cap on charter schools in California, and we have to increase that number dramatically. Because A, they do a better job, but B, it also gives parents choice. So if your child is in a D school, you have someplace to go. And then last, we've got to pay the better teachers more. The gems of our education system are the great teachers. Big class sizes, small class sizes, not such good facilities, great facilities. Actually, the teachers make all the difference. So let's find a way to identify the great teachers and pay them more. And you might be saying, well, how in the world are you going to do that in a budget crisis? Well, we have to look at how we spend the $50 billion that the state government spends every year on public education. Plus, we get another $20 billion from the federal government. It's hard to know exactly, but roughly 50 to 60% of that spend actually goes to overhead, not to in-classroom spending. So let's say it's 50%. Could we move some of that so we had 60% in the classroom, 40% in administration and overhead? Because that's where the learning takes place. That's where the English as a second language learners are. That's where the gifted students are. That's where the special needs kids are. So I want to focus, as I said, on three things: creating and keeping jobs in California, cutting government spending so we can choose to make investments into the things we really care about, and then finally, fixing our K-12 education system. So I know we can turn California around. It will not be easy, but I know we can do it. But I cannot do it alone. I will need each and every one of your help. So what I'd love to do now is turn it over to Joe for questions, and let's have a great discussion about the future of California. So thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Meg Whitman, former president and CEO of eBay and current Republican candidate for governor of the state of California. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be conducting the audience question portion of today's program. Now, Meg, I always like to try to create some categories to sort of stay in sync with the guests' talk and to make sense, logical sense. So I want to have tell you that there'll be questions today on jobs, of course, on our budget, something that you really didn't spend too much time on, possible constitutional changes in the state of California. Many have called it a dysfunctional state. And some questions also on the cost of the campaign, possibly getting into some ideas of yours on campaign finance reform. But before I get into the hardcore questions, I read an article today or yesterday. I want to go back to your eBay experience on the technology of Skype. Can you tell us a little bit about Skype? It's fascinating, and I think you sold Skype at some point a few years ago.
Yeah. So Skype is voice over the internet protocol, and basically what allows you to do is make calls, and both handset calls as well as video calls over the internet. And it was a great company that eBay bought that grew remarkably fast. It was fundamentally disrupting the telecom business in many ways. And we acquired eBay. Later on, after I left, actually eBay recently sold 70% of Skype back to a private investor group and held 30%. So it'll be very interesting to see. I have great hopes for Skype. It is one of the fastest growing companies that you can imagine, actually faster growing than eBay, Yahoo, almost as fast growing as Google. It's about a $600 million company with well over 500 million users worldwide.
Wow.
Any of you who have relatives and friends overseas, it's the greatest thing ever.
Or grandkids. Right, right. So you're not running against Carly Fiorina because you're running for different offices, but Carly Fiorina recently was quoted as saying that bankruptcy for California should always be considered. What is your view?
Well, as Carly well understood, I think, California can actually not go bankrupt. There is no legal framework for California to go bankrupt. So what do we do to get our fiscal house in order? And as I said, my view is the only sustainable way to increase revenues in California is to get the economy jump-started, to put people back to work. Without employers, there are no employees. And we've got to make California a better place to do business. That is the only way I see to increase revenues. And then we've got to look at the cost side of the equation. As I mentioned, we have the cold, hard truth here is we have a government we can no longer afford. So how do we run the government most efficiently and effectively? And what I'd like to do at the end of my first term is have all of you come to Sacramento, sit with me, look at the books, and I'd like to be able to say to you, we are spending your money as efficiently and effectively as you would if you could sit next to me. And that is what we owe the people of California. And then we can create some capacity to invest. Right now, because revenues are constantly running below costs, we have no capacity to invest. For example, the water conveyance system, the infrastructure in the state. You know what? I am in favor of this water bond. It is not a perfect bond. There is spending in that bond that I would like to have seen removed. But the fact is, progress, I believe, perfection is the enemy of progress. And we've got to support this water bond because it's in the interest of all Californians. But we've got to create some investment capacity to service the debt on that bond. We have enormous debt levels. So let's run the government more efficiently so we can choose to make the investments that we want to make. Is it in the UC system? Is it in the K-12 education system? Is it in lower taxes? Is it in streamlined regulation? There is no shortage of investments that need to be made in California. Let's run what we do far more efficiently so we can be enlightened about those investments.
Well, I understand, and I think we all understand, particularly thanks to your explanation, that California cannot go bankrupt. But California supports itself in many instances with the selling of bonds. Bonds can be defaulted on. We remember Orange County as an example. Do you think maybe Carly Fiorina was talking about that?
You know, I'm not sure I wasn't there. I mean, there's no question that we have to focus on the financial, putting our fiscal house in order. We are carrying debt levels that are unprecedented. A big chunk of our general fund goes to servicing debt every year. So think about it. It's almost like we're using current income to pay off credit card bills. It's just not the right thing. So my view is we've got to put our fiscal house in order. We've got to be smart about how we do this. And you know why I know we have got to make a change here? You know, I think it was Einstein who said the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over again and hoping for different results. We have got to take a different approach in Sacramento. And I think the people of California are ready for this. You know, I have now been a full-time candidate for well over a year. I've done over 300 campaign events. I've done over 150 media events. And I will tell you, people are desperately concerned about the fiscal situation in California. You know, normally spending is not a very sexy political issue. People aren't excited about hearing about spending normally. I will tell you, I get more questions about government spending and how we can be more efficient than I ever dreamed, because people are desperately worried that we are spending our way into oblivion, and we have to turn this around.
I have a good friend who also is in the steel business that several years ago decided because of the cost of doing business in California and because of the price of energy, this was during the energy crisis, he moved his very large steel factory to Mexico. You mentioned Colorado is taking business from California, and there are other states as well. So the question really is here, according to Moody's Economy.com website, California's cost of doing business is 17% above the national average and 24% above Oregon. Could you elaborate a little bit more on who the real competition is, states, in terms of states and countries taking business out of California?
Yeah. So there's no question that we are losing jobs, first and foremost, to neighboring states. We do, of course, lose some jobs to India and China and Eastern Europe. But if we could stop the job loss to neighboring states, we would be a long way towards solving our economic problems. And you know the way I think about jobs in California? I think of it as a bathtub. Incoming from the faucet is innovation. We still lead the nation in innovation. Biotech, high tech, green tech, you name it. In fact, agriculture. You know who deserves the innovation of the year award in California? It's the farmers. What they have done with so little water and regulation is really quite remarkable. So we have to keep this innovation engine going. And one of the things I will say is while we try to fix our kindergarten through 12th grade education system, we cannot take our eye off our higher education system. Higher education in California is still the envy of not only the United States and the world. So we have got to preserve those ecosystems of, for example, UC San Diego and biotech, UC Berkeley and high tech, UC Davis and agriculture, UC Irvine and the medical devices. Those ecosystems of academia and innovation are just priceless. Other states would love to have those ecosystems. So we've got to keep the innovation engine going. This has to be the very best place to start a business. But think about the water draining out of the bathtub. We've got to plug that hole in the bathtub, which means we have to keep jobs from leaving for Colorado, Arizona, Texas, Nevada, Utah. Those are the main states that we lose jobs to. And Texas is not a perfect state by any means, but they are way ahead of us in terms of being a business-friendly state. In 2008, Texas, this is interesting to statistics, 52% of all new jobs created in the entire United States in 2008 were created in Texas. Think about that for a minute. It's because they cut their budget by $10 billion, reinvested in lower taxes, they streamlined the regulatory process, and they created ombudsmen to bring industries to Texas. So it's no secret about what to do. It is the will to get it done and the leadership that is going to be required.
Well, Meg, we're definitely going to get to questions on education. So I just want everybody to know that. We will get there soon. But this last answer was a great segue to a question here on NAFTA. You mentioned Texas. Texas and California both border on Mexico. Neither on Canada, of course. But do you think NAFTA has been good or bad for California and the United States? As governor, will you take a close look at NAFTA to review its impact on jobs in our state?
So my personal view is we have got to be, as the United States of America and as Californians, we have to be free traders. It is not in the best interest of California or the United States to erect barriers. We have to be able to compete worldwide. In fact, I don't know how many of you know, but a big chunk of our of California's GDP, I'm not precisely sure of the number, but I think it's about 25% of our GDP is actually export-import. And we are uniquely positioned on the Pacific Rim. So I think in return, of course, we have to expect a level playing field. eBay was founded on a level playing field. We have to have a level playing field. We have to insist upon that in our trade relations. But net-net, I would say NAFTA has been a benefit to the United States of America and to California.
That's very interesting. Do you think that a lot of people are knowledgeable enough and have the data in which to make a determination about NAFTA?
I think voters are very smart, and I think people do understand that if we are competing internationally on a level playing field, then it is the right thing for us to open our borders so we can sell more products overseas, to source products into the United States. So I actually think that it's a complicated subject, but I have been deeply impressed that voters throughout California have actually quite detailed understandings of many different aspects of economics, of how things work. So I think there's a pretty good understanding of this. I do.
Thank you. Several questions, quite a few questions, have been submitted about the type of jobs that should be created in California. We are, as a nation, known as a service economy, and we're certainly going that way more and more. But how about sustainable jobs in industries like manufacturing, a lot of industries that we've lost overseas?
Yeah. So I think we need to defend manufacturing in California. Everyone thinks we have lost all the manufacturing jobs here. In fact, it's not true. We have either the number one or number two single largest number of manufacturing jobs in the country. And we cannot afford to lose another one. So let's be smart about how we treat manufacturers. Let's be smart. Remember I talked about those targeted tax relief. I think this notion of eliminating the factory tax, as I said, that sales tax that manufacturers pay on capital equipment to manufacture, is enormously helpful to manufacturers. And it's not just heavy equipment manufacturers. It's manufacturers who make everything from handbags to apparel to high-tech to biotech. This is a very important thing. And we cannot afford to lose more manufacturing jobs out of this state. And I don't think it is a foregone conclusion. If we focus on it, and the next governor of California is deeply focused on how do we create a better business climate for all businesses in California, we will bring along manufacturers.
We have a few more questions before we switch gears to another topic on jobs. But first, I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Meg Whitman, Republican candidate for governor of the state of California. Here's a question about a payroll tax break. Actually, it came from no one in California but Senators Chuck Schumer and Orrin Hatch, and they are recommending a payroll tax break to employers that hire workers who have been unemployed for at least 60 days. This tax break would mean that an employer would not have to pay 6.2% Social Security payroll tax on a new hire. Do you think that's a good plan?
So here's the issue. We have got to figure out, in my view, how to create a better business climate in the United States. I'm sure that's what Schumer and Hatch are talking about, and in California. I think in many ways, in a targeted way. I think this proposal has some real merit. The question is, in the context of the federal deficit, because that's what, of course, we're talking about here, is this the priority that you would put in all the different stimulus and all the different things that you can theoretically spend money on as the government? Where does this fall in the priority list? There is not an unlimited and open pocketbook here. So if you look at all the other things, is this something that you would invest in because you think it would create the most amount of jobs? Remember, it is not the job of government to create jobs. What the government needs to do is create the conditions for small businesses to grow and thrive. So that is the screen by which the criteria I would look at all these different proposals and say, how are we doing? Are we doing the very best job we can to create the conditions for small businesses to grow and thrive, as opposed to give near-term incentives that might not be sustainable?
Well, not to be outdone by two of our fine senators, President Obama has a plan. What do you think of the president's proposal to give companies a $5,000 tax credit for each new worker that they hire in 2010? Also, companies that increase wages and or hours worked for current workers would be reimbursed for any extra Social Security payroll taxes.
Well, the first thing I would say is I am delighted that President Obama has turned his attention to jobs. This is the number one issue facing the state of California, and I am delighted that he has pivoted to jobs in such a meaningful way. So good for him for focusing on this. Now the question is, what is the very best thing the federal government can do, as I said, to create the conditions? I think this proposal has merit. It should be looked at. But in the context of everything else that the government can do, is this the most beneficial thing for small businesses? And my view is where I would start is I would start with streamlining regulation. I would start with targeted tax relief that actually will spur employment and that we can afford in a systematic way.
We're finally going to get to another topic here, which is our budget. Governor Schwarzenegger is asking the Obama administration for $6.9 billion the governor says is owed to California. The feds disagree with this amount. In fact, even California Senators Boxer and Feinstein, as well as our Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, also disagree. And they claim that stimulus funds under the Recovery Act are and will be provided to California to help the state's financial mess. Can you comment, please?
I can. So I think it's true that, California is owed money by the federal government. For example, the illegal immigrant population in our prisons is enormously expensive. So we are owed money by the federal government, and I hope that the federal government will contribute to the budget deficit. I will tell you that realistically, I'm not sure that it's going to happen on anywhere near the magnitude that Governor Schwarzenegger would like. He is not the first governor to try to retrieve monies from the federal government. So my view is we have to take responsibility for putting our own fiscal house in order. We can't hope that the federal government will bail us out. So let's be really thoughtful about it. Let's tackle the issues that are right in front of us. Let's utilize technology. You know, everyone in this audience has had technology impact their lives, the companies you work for. You know, how many of you have to say, listen, next year we have to be either, we have to do the same amount for 10% less cost, or we got to do 10% more for the same cost? That is not a discipline that exists in Sacramento. And we have got to fundamentally change the way we think about this. And you would be surprised, I think, to learn of the state of the IT infrastructure that powers the state of California. For the most technologically advanced state in the country, the home of Silicon Valley that has changed everything, the home of the Bay Area that has allowed us to do things we never dreamed were possible but because of technology, we haven't exported that incredible talent to Sacramento. And one of the things that I think we need to think about, you know, people ask me every single day, how will you get anything done? They ask it a little bit more politely than that. But what they mean is, this all sounds great, Meg. I love jobs. I love spending. I love fixing education. But how will you actually get anything done? So it turns out that the governor of California really has four levers that you can pull. First is the appointments process. The governor of California makes 3,000 appointments to his or her administration. And the top 300 of which are incredibly important because they're your agency heads, your department heads, and the gubernatorial nominations to the 395 boards and commissions that we have in California. By the way, as an aside, we don't need 395 boards and commissions. But those 300 people are essential. I did not run eBay by myself. I'm not running this campaign by myself. I will not govern California by myself. Those 300 people are absolutely essential. They need to be the right people in the right job on the same agenda as the governor. I will interview every one of those individuals. And I think of those 300, a third need to come from the private sector. Because it's hard to ask the civil service to reinvent themselves from the inside out. And the reason I bring this up is coming back to technology. I think we're going to have a healthy dose from the private sector to redo the entire technology infrastructure that runs the state. The second point I would make in terms of how you get things done is the governor has to work with the legislature. It's true, but the legislature has to work with the governor because the governor has line item veto in California. And I think we need to focus the legislature on the existing crisis. What has happened in California is the legislature in many ways has become a bill factory. Last year, 652 or 692 pieces of legislation were signed into existence, virtually none of which, some of which, but not much of which was on point to the crisis that we face. So how about we stop doing new things and focus on fixing our existing problems? Let's focus the legislature on creating jobs, on cutting government spending, and in fixing our education system. You know, of the legislature, who wants to be on the jobs team? Republicans, Democrats, Independents, I don't know anyone who's not worried about jobs in their district, in their county. So let's take a different approach. And then last, what I would say is, you know, the next governor of California, this is not an easy job. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is hard, this is probably a 12. And I think if you have a huge need to be liked, a need to be popular, this is a very bad job, person fit. Because think about it, half the people will be upset with you all the time. And while you're taking on the education establishment, the business climate, 75% of the people will be upset with you. And you have to have a core set of values that you know why you were sent to Sacramento, and you're going to have to lead in a way that that I think will require, in many ways, a real spine of steel. The next governor of California has to know exactly what she believes, and she needs to stick with it.
Well, I think you'll do just fine should you be chosen. You did mention that you've been asked more than once, why would anybody want this job? So the question that I'm going to ask that pertains to that is, and we have at least three or four questions to this point, could you please evaluate our current governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, on the kind of job that he's done?
So I have a lot of respect for Governor Schwarzenegger. He stood up and was counted and chose to serve. And he's done a couple of very good things for the state of California. He overhauled workmen's compensation. When you talk to small businesses in California, they will tell you that made an enormous difference. We're starting to backslide in workmen's compensation, but that was an excellent reform. The redistricting proposition, Proposition 11, which seeks to reduce the gerrymandering, or the gerrymandering, depending on how people say it. Actually, technically, it's gerrymandering. That seeks to reduce that, I think, is a good thing. He passed that initiative, and we now have a citizens commission that is, I think, will make these districts far more competitive. I actually think he did a good thing on the water bond, as I said. This was a hard-fought piece of legislation that, you know, they've been trying to put together a water solve for the state for the last 20 years. That said, in the end, the leader of this state has to be accountable for results. And the results are not good. As I said, the unemployment rate, the infrastructure, our K through education system, Governor Schwarzenegger probably has not made as much progress as he would have liked to have made. And so the next governor of California has to take a different approach, solve problems. You know, as I see, and when I travel around this state, you know what people want? They just want people to go solve the problem. They understand that there's all kinds of challenges, but they want a leader who has a vision, who can solve problems. And in particularly in this point in time, someone who has created jobs, someone who's balanced a budget, someone who deeply understands the economy and can inject a healthy dose of business discipline into the government, I think is going to be an important element. The state of California will never be a business. It shouldn't be a business. There's so many things the government provides that are essential to people truly in need. But if we really want to provide for those truly in need, and there is no shortage of needs out there in this economic crisis, we got to run our shop more efficiently so we can do more for the people who need it the most.
California isn't the only state in the nation with a growing gaming industry. With growing budget deficits, California and other states have expanded Indian gaming to help close the budget gap, and I guess gaming that is not Indian as well. I know you are against raising taxes, but isn't that preferable to the expansion of gambling as a revenue source?
So actually the only authorized form of gambling in the state of California, as I understand it, is in fact Indian gaming. There's internet gaming, but that's, you know, sort of without, that's cross-border. Mm-hmm. And so the Indians have the right to casinos and three types of gaming in California. And my view is that actually I won't be raising taxes. I think that's the wrong thing to do. But I also don't think that at this juncture we can look to the Indian tribes for incremental monies. Their revenues are down tremendously. Their communities are in enormous need. They are sovereign nations. We need to deal with them in fairness. And my view is this is not the place to go to close the budget gap. The place to go to close the budget gap is create more jobs in California and get our government spending, the $150 billion $85 billion special fund plus general fund, or the $85 billion of special fund, this is where we have to look to first. I think that is the sustainable way to fundamentally get our budget back in balance.
There's a Houston oil development company that states they would like to drill offshore in California, and they state that the state of California could realize between $2 and $4 billion in oil lease revenues. It doesn't sound like that much money considering our fiscal crisis, but how much revenue do you think could be expected from new drilling off the coast of Santa Barbara, for example, and how concerned would you be about possible ecological damage if drilling were allowed?
Right. So I want to come back to the notion of how much money is real money in a minute. But I'm very cautious about drilling offshore in California. Historically, I have been against this. The risk to the environment, in my view, is too great. That said, there have been tremendous technology advances in offshore oil drilling. And I know better than most that technology can allow you to do things you've never done before. So I think it's something that we ought to look at, but I need to be convinced that the ecological environmental risk is close to zero. I wouldn't do it for incremental monies. What I think the best argument is, how can we help America get off foreign oil? Because in the end, if we don't reduce our dependence on foreign oil, we don't stop funding people in countries who don't like us very much, we end up with tremendous foreign affairs challenges. But let's come back to this notion that $2.5 billion isn't very much money. It's fascinating. There is no silver bullet to solving California's crisis. We're going to find it $100 million at a time, $300 million at a time. I was talking to someone the other day, and I mentioned that by shrinking the size of the government workforce back down to where we were just 5 years ago would save $3.3 billion a year. And the person said to me, well, that's not very much money. Okay, the day that we decide $3.3 billion is not very much money is a huge problem. And I actually thought it was kind of emblematic of the problem we face. I mean, did you know that we own a printing company? The state of California owns a printing company that costs the state about $100 million a year. My first question is, why are we printing anything? And if we have to print something, do we need a full-time printing plant, or could we contract with a private company that could provide the printing needs at probably about half the cost? And it's only $100 million, but we're going to find $100 million here, $50 million there, $300 million there. And that's how we're going to close this budget deficit. I can tell you from having managed costs in business for 30 years, there's never a silver bullet. There's not a $15 billion cost reduction item in this budget. It's by being smart about every penny you spend. And the government has to say, if this were my money, would I be spending it this way? And I can tell you the answer to that right now is no.
Well, I have to plead guilty. That comment about $2 billion not being a lot of money was my editorial comment.
Oh, sorry about that, Joe. Oops.
Yeah, it is a lot of money. I agree. And I understand your point. It's well taken. It's a little bit at a time. So there was a question earlier about selling California bonds, or actually about the possible default of bonds. But if our legislature drags its feet in balancing the budget, how will that affect our ability to sell bonds and to support public works?
I'm sorry, say that again?
So if our legislature drags its feet in balancing the budget, how will that affect our ability to sell bonds?
It will not be good, obviously. The controller of the state of California estimates that we will once again start issuing IOUs sometime this spring. This is never a good thing. And so the legislature does need to get about solving the near-term crisis, which, as you know, is about a $6 billion shortfall between now and June. And this is not easy because a lot of the long-term planning and work has not been done. One of the things that's interesting is that the next governor of California who takes office in 2011, you've got to start working on the budget conceptually in 2013, 2014. Because all of you who have run businesses know that if you're going to make fundamental change by utilizing technology to improve productivity, you don't roll out a new technology system in January and it works by March and you've got savings by June. These are investments that take time. So we've got to start, while we solve the current budget crisis, we've got to make investments that will pay off later, that will fundamentally restructure how we do business in the state of California. So I think the legislature legislature's got to take this up. If we continue, if we issue IOUs again, the bond rating will go down, which will increase the cost of borrowing, which will actually make the budget deficit worse.
Yes. Thank you. So if I were to state one overriding theme to the, many of the questions that I've received tonight, I'd have to say that it is the dysfunctional politics of California. We talked about dysfunctionality. We all read about it every day. We see it on television. We see it on the internet. Hear it on the radio. So there's been a movement to get a constitutional convention on the June ballot here in California. That takes money because it requires signatures, and it costs a lot of money to get signatures. But apparently, according to the Public Policy Institute of California, the shortfall of the $1 million required is very, very real. Have you been following that? What do you think about that? Do you think there should be a constitutional convention initiative on the ballot?
So I read earlier this week that the group that is behind this constitutional convention has really suspended the fundraising to raise the amount of signatures that are required because the fundraising has been so small. Yeah, they don't think they can make it.
Maybe the Bay Area Council, I think.
Yeah, the Bay Area Council. Right. And they basically suspended the effort because they don't think they can raise the money. So I think a constitutional convention has actually real merit in many ways. You know, we have now the second longest constitution next to any state in the union, next to Alabama. And I think if we knew what we knew now, would we write a different constitution? The answer to that is yes. But the devil is in the detail. Who sits on the Constitutional Convention? How is it convened? What issues are we going to tackle? And what I don't want to see is a Constitutional Convention that's sole objective is to overturn the two-thirds majority that is required to pass a tax increase and required to pass a budget. So if there is real merit and a real level playing field, I think there's some interesting things that we could tackle in the context of the Constitution. But I'm also a pragmatist, and my view is the next governor of California is not going to have a new constitution, and we better figure out how to make things work with the constitution that we have.
So if there is an initiative for a constitutional question, or if there is not an initiative, there should be California reform of the governance of the state. And the real bad boy, the real elephant in the room, seems to be Proposition 13. People have been talking about Prop 13. So what is your view on Prop 13? Should that be on the table in reform of governance in California?
I don't actually think it should be. Property taxes are the one cost-effective thing that we have in California as both citizens and businesses. And people talk a lot about should we have split roles, meaning individuals abide by Prop 13, but businesses no longer have the advantages of Prop 13. And my view is this is completely the wrong thing. It is the one thing that we can point to businesses as a cost-effective reason to stay in California, that your property taxes will be relatively low. People say it's the part of the reason that we don't have the money to run the state. I don't think that's true either. If you look at the percentage of revenues that come in through taxes, the actual dollars per capita per citizen in California, we are in the top 10 states in the union. So while our tax makeup is different, we have a lower percentage of property tax than we do of sales tax or personal income tax. The fact of the matter is the total revenues that come into the state are competitive. And we have got to work the cost side of that. And as I said, because we are reliant on personal income tax and business income tax and sales tax, we've got to get the economy going again. Because if people are employed, employers are hiring people, they're paying taxes, individuals are paying taxes, they're spending money, so they're paying sales taxes. That's the way to solve the revenue crisis. So I don't think that we should touch Prop 13.
Actually, you're in agreement. You are in total agreement with a recent Commonwealth Club speaker, Tom Campbell, who's now running for senator. But I'm not going to ask if you think that's a good thing or a bad thing. But the fact is that he is, and he's a very capable individual. And he said that when he was the state finance director, that it was the best arrow in his quiver that he had to sell California to businesses out of state, that we did have control over property taxes.
It's the one competitive advantage that we have. I'd like to create other competitive advantages to keep businesses right in California, but that's the one we have, and let's not give away that one.
How about the open primary? On the June ballot in California, primary voters will get an opportunity to vote on an open primary. This is a system that some people have referred to as the top two vote getters. And if adopted, studies have shown that there could be a more moderate political climate in the state legislature, and I know you addressed that earlier.
Yeah. So I actually am for the notion of an open primary. The precise open primary that has been suggested I don't think is the right thing, because it does let the top two vote-getters run for the ultimate office. And so what it could mean, in many districts, it's two Republicans. In many districts, it's two Democrats. I'm a big believer in the two-party system. And so let's make these districts fairer. Let's make a primary fairer so that you get there's more competition between Republicans and Democrats. What's happened, of course, is that so many districts are safe in California that if you are a Republican, you're worried about what they call primary, meaning that someone who is even more conservative than you knocks you out of the box. Likewise, on the Democratic side, someone who's even more liberal than you is knocked out. So I think we ought to have an open primary, but not the kind that just results in the top two.
Meg, didn't you talk briefly in your prepared remarks about Proposition 11?
I did.
You did mention that. So that's the redistricting proposition. So every 10 years, the federal government has a census, and once they get the results of that census, they have a reapportionment of the 435 seats of the Congress, but then the states have to follow up, as I understand it, with redistricting plans. Today happens to be a very important day because in Proposition 11, it was determined that there would be a committee, for lack of a better word, of volunteers who would determine what the redistricting plan would be. And today is the last day, if in case anyone here is interested, that you could volunteer to be a member of this redistricting committee. What is your view on redistricting?
As I said, I was a supporter of Proposition 11. Mm-hmm. I think this was the right thing to do. I think a citizen commission can do a very good job of appropriately redrawing the lines so that they make sense. And so I'm very hopeful about this. It will take a number of years to know whether it really works, because you've got to get through a few election cycles. You've got to get through the 2010 census, and then you've got to get through a few election cycles. But I'm very hopeful that this will make a big difference to California.
So higher education in California is in jeopardy, the quality higher education. Cal Berkeley and UCLA are providing an education, according to many, which is equal to Stanford and the Ivy League schools. So shouldn't their tuition go up to the level of those other schools in order to ease California's educational budget burden?
So my answer to that is actually no. We have the envy of the world is our UC system. There was a report that was recently issued that listed the top 15 public universities in America, and California had 6 or 7 of the top universities. This is something we should be incredibly proud about. And the fact that we have provided access to a vast majority of California children over time, regardless of their ability to pay, I think is something that we should stand up for and we should be really proud of. And as I said before, while we are working this budget, while we are saving money to invest, we cannot compromise the UC system. This is another one of those things where we are a winner, where we have a competitive advantage, not unlike Prop 13. Let's not destroy this. Let's fully fund the UC system. Let's fund that innovation. Let's make sure that in 3 or 4 years' time, we have another major UC system in that top 15 universities. So I'm an enormous defender of the UC system. And I had an interesting chance to meet with the Chancellor, Mark Udoff, the other day, who said, listen, those first set of budget cuts maybe made us better. You know, everyone can operate a little bit more efficiently if a little more pressure is put on. But we have to be very careful that we don't cut into real muscle here and compromise what has been the innovation engine of California. And as I said, those ecosystems between the private enterprise and the public university system, every other state in the union tries to figure out how we do it. Austin does it a bit. Route 128 in Boston does it a bit. But we cannot lose these fabulous ecosystems of public, private enterprise systems. This is the source of the innovation engine, and I think we have to defend that at all costs. And I don't think we should be raising fees because I think it does discourage very qualified kids.
So So are we going to see you in front of Sather Gate in Berkeley picketing with some of the students? I think not. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the time in our program where there is just time for one last question, and it has to do with your voting record, an issue which has been all over the airwaves and the newspapers. So do you think that your poor voting record will hurt your chances for winning the gubernatorial race?
Well, I think the voters will ultimately decide that. And there's no question that I did not vote as often as I should. I did not do my civic duty, and there is no excuse for it, and I'm fully accountable for it. And the fact is, I was not as focused on politics as I might have. I'm not sure I thought as I was a young adult that it made as much difference as I do now. So you might ask, what changed that point of view? And a couple of things. One is eBay. I saw every single day how government got in the way of small businesses, and I saw the power of those small businesses. I think the other thing is, as I dug deeply into the challenges that those businesses faced, that the state of California faced, I think politics may be the only way out of this mess. It really matters who we elect. It really matters the legislation that we enact or don't enact in terms of turning this state around. So I am 100% invested in this. And the voters of California will have to look at that part of my record along with everything else I bring to the table, and they will have to decide.
Okay. Thank you. Our thanks to Meg Whitman, former president and CEO of eBay and current Republican candidate for governor of the state of California. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. My name is Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you very much for attending.